Here we come a-waffling along the leaves so green. We're talking a Claymation Christmas Celebration album by Patrick J. Miller. Hit it. It was 1988. Steve Winwood rolled with it. The Land Before Time was released. The Consumer Product Safety Commission banned the sale of lawn darts. And Patrick J. Miller arranged some amazing versions of classic Christmas carols. I'm your host, Jerry D., with another episode of Totally Rad Christmas, the podcast that talks all things Christmas in the 80s. Toys, movies, specials, music, and fads. If it was gnarly during Christmas in the 80s, we got it covered. Now, joining me is an exceptionally special guest. You'll know him as the composer and arranger of the Claymation Christmas Celebration special and album. It's Patrick Miller. Patrick, how's it going?
Hey, good. what a fun idea for a podcast.
Well, you know, I love the 80s and I love Christmas, so I thought let's smash them together and see what happens.
I've got five daughters and they keep telling me the 80s is back. So, there's parts of the 80s I don't want back, but it's okay. We'll go there. It's all good.
I understand. Reading through, so I've known about your website for some years now, and reading through the story, I definitely can see why you might not want some of those years back.
It was, well, I mean, 99% of it was great fun, as we can talk about. There was 1% that wasn't so fun, but we'll go from there. That's the way life is, though, right? 99%, that's good. That's a good percentage of fun.
Hey, 99%, I'd take that, any day.
Yeah.
Congratulations on your daughter's upcoming wedding as well. So,
daughter number 5, that makes things way different. There's a lot of relief and holy goodness sakes, I can't wait for this to be over. It's going to be great. This is the daughter that promised she was going to get married in a small ceremony on the beach. There's 225 people coming out to the woods. We built a hobbit door last week. That should give you really good idea of how insane this thing is. But it's going to be fun. Great fun. Thanks for the for the congrats.
Yeah. Well, hey, I mean, my kids are still like the oldest just turned 10. So I still got a ways, but I'm still kind of dreading it. So I can imagine everything you're at least going through right now. But
it's usually
a great time. Yeah.
Yeah. It's great fun.
But before we dive into it, tell us a little bit about yourself. Like how did you get started in music?
Music has always been part of my life. I mean, I was blessed by having parents that loved music. Neither one were musical per se, but they loved music. So my mom was into show tunes and musicals and et cetera, et cetera. My dad was way into Dixieland jazz. He in the military, he was able to hear some of the best of the best in the 50s. So I grew up around music. And then I did kind of the traditional music nerd thing. While I was a jock and an athlete, I also was in the boys choir in church and then the choir middle school, and then band. I started on clarinet, and my teacher was actually a guy that had played in Benny Goodman's orchestra. So he was way into letting you go ahead and just figure stuff out and improvise. It was very cool. And then I was blessed all the way through junior high and high school with having exceptional teachers who really let us do our own thing. So I was 99% self-taught, but it was always part of my life.
Well, and your sister is pretty operatic as well, isn't she?
Yeah, she is the opera singer. She almost went to Europe to study. She got married and then went into teaching, et cetera. She still has the pipes. To this day, she can still take your shoelaces off at 40 paces. So she's pretty talented.
Well, and that's similar to me. I'm a, I'm not an opera singer, but I was in band as well. I was even a band director for a bit before I realized I like having a life. But my brothers were all state tenors, and so they can dazzle you with all the with the vocal stuff. And you know, I get by. I like to say I play composer's piano, and I can, you know, I can get by singing. But
well, I think the key for me, the big change for me, was in middle school. I went from playing then bass, clarinet, and saxophone to playing drums, because I figured out there was way more girls involved with drums. So I went to drums, and that really did change my life, because it opened my mind up to, you know, different meters and different types of ways you can approach music. So it has had a long lasting effect.
And you can hear a lot of polyrhythmic elements on your on this album that we're going to be talking about as well. So
yeah,
that's pretty cool. But besides Dixieland and you know, some of the show tunes and things, what else were some of your influences? Like,
well, I, like most kids that grew up in the 60s and 70s, the Beatles were kind of Beatles and the Beach Boys were kind of everything to everybody. The British Invasion was a pretty big deal, but the Beatles absolutely were, you know, they changed. With new every album, it changed basically what people thought about popular music. I then went through the transition, much to my mother's chagrin, of getting into Led Zeppelin and a couple of other heavier metal bands, including Black Sabbath at one point. When I was still playing and doing other kinds of things, I traded in a guitar for an electric guitar, et cetera, et cetera. But then at that point, I really got into the singer-songwriter thing in high school. And so Elton John, James Taylor, Jackson Browne, the whole Elektra Asylum crew. And then really, I where you kind of hear some influences on even the stuff I produced for this record, Peter Gabriel and the whole world beat scene kind of cropped up. I was avoiding disco with both hands held outside, and Gabriel came along and was able to make things, and Little Feet and some of those people then. But now my tastes are so wide, you can't really tag them. Newgrass, Bluegrass, Randy Newman, Tom Waits, I mean, all those guys. So that's a nutshell. Lots and lots of music influence.
Yeah, well, and you can hear it. There's all sorts of things on this, and we'll talk about it when we get there. But but yeah, you can definitely hear all sorts of influences. So that's really cool. I'm right there with you as far as just liking all sorts of things. And I too went through a heavier heavy metal stage where I liked Blue Oyster Cult and Black Sabbath and Deep Purple and all that. And
I think everybody has to do that. Just it's a form of rebellion, but it's a pretty safe form of rebellion as long as the drugs don't go along with it, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
The lifestyle.
A lot of that stuff, like Yes and Deep Purple and some of the prog rock, I mean, they really go out there with their experimentation as far as, you know, as meter and rhythm and harmony.
Amazing musicianship too. I mean, Yes and that crew were my college days, and absolutely they were in my immediate constant playlist. So,
well, and Peter Gabriel is an interesting influence because I mean, when he started using the Fairlight, I mean, just producing all sorts of cool sounds and just so.
Well, I think again, he has a drummer's sensibility, but the difference with him, I think, is that he opened himself up to world music, particularly African music, early on, and was not afraid to go into, you know, the roots of polyrhythm. I mean, I firmly believe that if you go back far enough, everything came out of Africa, basically, including even Anglican chants and all that stuff. It's still rooted in 1/4/5s and the same types of harmonies and the repetitive, you know, stuff that's there. And so it wasn't very hard for me to figure out, you know, that it kind of felt good to have some kind of a drone in the back with something else playing against it. And, you know, there was a lot of opportunity there. But anyway, that's music nerd talk.
Hey, I'm right there with you. I was a composition minor, so no worries to me.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, Stravinsky, Bartok. I even like Berg. I mean, they're some of my favorites there. But let's get into this Claymation Christmas special first.
Next, it's musical magic with those California raisins, caroling camels, waltzing walruses, and Herman Rex on the all-new Claymation Christmas celebration.
How'd you like get started with Will Vinton? Like how'd you hook up with him?
Well, it's a hilarious story. So I, in the early, late 70s and early 80s, all the way for years and years, I had an ad agency on the side, and I was doing jingle music. I was doing things for my own clients where I, you know, was picking up one of the first synthesizers, you know, the Yamaha came out, and it you could make different whatevers. And I started with a TAC 40 or 3440, and then I went into a Fostex 8-track quarter inch, and was using it primarily for commercial production. But I, on the side, was messing around with music, and a guy here locally did, I hope he's not listening, a horrendous local production of kind of a mystery thing. John Logue was the videographer and the kind of director for it. John Logue, this soft-spoken, kind of brilliant mind guy, was working on this project. And I did the music for this thing for free. I just threw it in. And so at the so-called rap party, we were talking, and he mentioned casually that he was working on a kid's video for Christmas music, kids video. And, you know, if I wanted to submit a demo, I think he was just being polite. And, you know, if I wanted to submit a demo, he'd take a listen to it with his buddy, Ralph Little. I jumped on it and over the weekend produced Waffling and, you know, some of the things, some of the basic things that were in the thing that were in the initial performances. And then I even did a rough thumbnail of Joy, the one that has kind of the African polyrhythm thing.
Yeah.
Joy to the world, the Lord has come. Let earth receive her King.
And then got a call on Tuesday, please come up. And so I went up and they said, hey, you know, we really want you to work on this project. And here's the deal. It's a 30-minute kids video. Vinton and his former wife, Susan Shadburn, did We Sing videos. That was kind of how they got their thing going.
Okay.
Anyway, bottom line is, this thing was supposed to be a 30-minute home video release with traditional Christmas carols and some humor and some basic humor, but it was very low key. Okay. That's kind of how the whole thing started. When you'd called, I went and looked through. I found my original contract for the deal, and it was $4,500 for the whole thing, to do this whole thing. But it was going to be very simple, you know, it was going to be a simple project. So at that point, everything, you know, changed. So
yeah, it definitely exploded and expanded. So like, what was the genesis of that? Like, how did that evolve?
So Joy ended up being like this catalyst for everybody going, oh, we could do, gee, this is cool. We could do. And so Ralph and John, who wrote the whole thing, in all honesty, Will had very little to do with this entire project, to be honest with you. It was mostly Ralph and John and a bunch of the team they put together. It wasn't supposed to be a big deal until it became a big deal. So we started with Joy, and they said, well, right. Are there any other things that you could try, you know, with this kind of flavor where you take a traditional song and make it hipper and whatever, blah, blah, blah. And so I did a couple more demos that were, you know, in that theme. I don't remember the exact ones. I think the Camels came in pretty early. There was something else. Anyway, at that point, they all said, hey, this thing's got legs. And of course, Vinton was known pretty much at that point for the California Raisins. And so they said, I wonder if we can get the Raisin board to sign off on this thing and get involved. And then it just went nutty, because then we had to get releases and we had to Then Ralph and I and a couple other guys sold it to CBS TV as a special. And then the dates and the changes and everything changed drastically, very, very, very quickly. So it's hard to emphasize that these things, usually you have years to work on an animated something because right. the process is pretty arduous. We had months, and most of that was really about 4 months that we were just cranking stuff. I mean, really cranking hard to get stuff done. So anyway, it went through several versions because every time right. they sold something, things got shortened, changed, new stuff got thrown in. The whole timber of it went from basically being a kid's video, like a We Sing, here's the Christmas songs, into this, right. let's trash every song we do, you know? So it got to be pretty hilarious by the time we were done.
So did you get to pick which songs they were doing, or was that all
with the audio or with the special? They had written the script and they had rough outlines of what they wanted to do.
Okay.
And so I would go back and then give them a new version or whatever. And we'd mess with it and mess around. But the process, particularly in this situation, was where the way it worked was they'd give me a rough script, sometimes with what they called animatronics, which is basically a storyboard with cartoon stuff driven out or kind of drawn out. Mm-hmm. And they'd say roughly how long it's going to be. And here's the dialogue. And this is kind of what we think we need you to do. And then I'd go back and make music that matched this stuff up. Then they'd animate to that. And then I would come back and do the finished versions and cut it for time and everything else. And so it was, it was challenging mm-hmm. and fun, you know. But as far as choosing the music for that, not as much. They had a script going and okay. we were really locked into time, it was like, okay, these are the ones we need to get done. So, and the animation process is arduous. So.
Right. Yeah, I can imagine, especially with clay.
It seems
like a harder medium to work with for some reason.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so when it was time to animate, put music to this, how did you come about compositionally? Like how did you come to it? Did you just kind of start throwing out random ideas? Did you kind of have a basic outline or...
Looking at the playlist of the special again, mm-hmm. it was kind of driven by script, and then just it became then really there. I can't say enough how lucky we were to have found this guy, Robert Keller, who was at the time still, I'm sure he still is. At the time, he was this brilliant, crazy professor / programmer dude who was writing a music sequencing program called Robert Keller's 48 Track at the time. And what it was a sequencing program that ran on pretty basic IBM computers. I mean, it ran like an 8088. But the resolution mm-hmm. of this thing was 3,000 pulses per quarter note, as opposed to 300, wow. which is kind of where all of the cakewalk and all that stuff that was out at that time. So for a drummer to be able to put something down and keep it there and not have it quantized automatically was a big deal. That was the first draw. The second mm-hmm. thing is that he was in town working in this house with no heat. And he would, I don't know when he slept, because he would say, well, what do you want it to do now? And I'd say, well, it'd be really cool if I could blah, 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 blah. And I'd lay out my wish list of what it would be able to do. And I'd come back a couple of days and he'd have me a new disc and I'd go back and it would work. So the big deal for this situation was it was one of the very first programs ever to run SMPTE time code that ran outside the box. SMPTE wasn't even really around at the time. Everything was 60 cycle, lock, right. lock with a click and everything else at that point. So this thing ran not only SMPTE, but he had this thing that was hit points where you could put in a point point A, point B, point whatever, lay down mm-hmm. the times, and it would slow and speed up in a way that was undiscernible to hit those points to 1/300th of a second minimum. And wow. so for stuff like the walrus dance is a great example of where, when the penguins plop back in, there was sound effects and music that had to hit right when those were pre-animated. So I had to go back mm-hmm. and track and pre-animate and put those in. I could never in a million years have done it in the time frame we had, you know, on the fly without right. his program, because I mean, it allowed me to just go in and just nail it. You know, it was great.
Well, and if it's speeding up and slowing down, you know, just slightly, you know, indiscernibly, but enough to actually hit that. I mean, I would think that would make it feel, you know, more as if acoustic human. Instruments were playing it anyway.
Yeah, it's more human. And the thing is, before that time, you know, as you probably know, soundtrack composers had this math book that was kind of the Bible, where you had to figure out measures and all this crazy math to, you know, to make something work in between gaps. This thing was, I mean, there's no way I could have done what I did in the time I did it, really, as kind of a one-man show, mostly for the TV special, particularly if I didn't have that program. That program was everything. And it, you know, it kind of hung around, and he tried to take it commercially, and then he got a job as a vice president with Microsoft, and that was the end of that. See ya, Robert.
So, wow. Anyway. Can you imagine where he could have been?
Well, I don't know.
He did pretty good.
No, he did very well at Microsoft. Yeah. Let's just put it that way. But because this was in the late 80s. But he would still be in the cold, freezing house, I'm guessing. But anyway, yeah, he was a great guy. And being able to say, look, it would be great if I could meld and do this and do a cross dissolve here and whatever, because nothing that was out was even remotely close to this thing. And so at that point, I was stacking up keyboards. I was doing everything I could do to get things, you know, to really open up the sounds, to give it more of a live human feel, you know, using some of the first samplers and things like that. So, again, that, I don't know if that was a tangent or down the right road. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think that goes, at least for me, that's like completely down the right road.
Okay.
So most of that special was done on synths, or were there any other acoustic instruments?
Yeah, there was acoustic. I mean, we played live. The running joke is that everybody in the neighborhood was a goose, because in the here we become the waddling. We needed more female voices. So my wife and next door neighbor and a bunch of other people are all geese at that point. We brought in Ralph Little wanted a crumb horn, period. He wanted a crumb horn.
This How did he even know ancient... what a crumb horn was?
He's
most
he's
people don't.
Like, he's one of those guys.
Okay,
and luckily for us, there was a lady who was an associate professor at U of O who played crumb horn, Julia Hayden. And she came over and laid down crumb horn tracks on two or three of the tunes that really made it feel. I mean, crumb horn is such a distinctive sound.
You know
what it is. You don't go into the Insonic library and find a crumb horn. Let's put it that way.
No, it's like a weird cross between like a bassoon and a clarinet and maybe a little oboe in there. I don't even know how to describe it, but I know what you're talking about.
I think it's like a pregnant oboe is kind of how I always describe it. It has more of a roundness than an oboe, but yeah. And they're nasty. I mean, they're nasty to keep tuned and everything else. She was quite good. She was very, very good. Then we did, there's a lot of sound effects. There's a lot of stuff that we played live. And then of course, I have to tell this story. The solo on Joy, the sax solo mm-hmm. on Joy, the original demo we did, I did in the basement of this house before we moved, and it literally was stuffed into this basement. And we had to get this track out, and we happened to be moving like the next week. So stuff was all unpacked and weird and everything else. So I stacked the stuff in. Warren Rand, who is a very well-known jazz player in the Portland area, was recommended to come down and play sax, and by a friend of mine, Terry Robb, who also was on the record. But Warren drove 2 and some hours. I think he was from North Portland, so like 2.5 hours from Portland, drove down. I had him mic'd in the laundry room. He walked in, played one take that was phenomenal and made not only the song in the show, but also the album. That solo stuck, and it's in the laundry room. And it is so indicative of the way the rest of the album was, because we'd bring people in, and wherever we could get a mic, we'd put it in, it was great fun. But we played for the TV show, it was a lot of samplers and synths and live drum. There was live drums, there was some guitar, but most of the TV show was purposefully trying to be a little bit more organic, a little bit more traditional. Even with like I think the juiciest thing we did was like putting a B3 on the Camels, bop thing,
Yeah. For the Camel singing section. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
We Three Kings bop.
Hill and mountain, moor and mountain, fall we yonder star.
Star of wonder, star of night, star with royal beauty bright, westward leading, still proceeding, guide us to that perfect light.
Yeah, yeah, which I think that's that one, and the bells is probably most people's favorite, if I had to guess.
It is if you're watching it, and that's where it gets weird for the Camels made the album, but if you have the visuals, then there's a lot of stuff that's great. I mean,
that makes more sense, yeah.
But it doesn't really stand up on its own as well as a pop record, which is what Atlantic wanted when we got to that point. So
gotcha. Okay, so the special's a huge hit. You even win an Emmy for it. And now you get a call that, hey, we're gonna do an album. So how do you decide what goes on or what stays from the special and what else needs to be added?
Yeah, that was literally like, Sophie's Choice of Choosing Children, because one of the very first things that got cut was Oh Christmas Tree, which was my two oldest daughters at I think they were 11 and 9 or 12 and 10. They sang the lead parts on Oh Christmas Tree. And so it killed me to pull it, but it just didn't have, it didn't fit with the rest of the stuff as it started going forward. So yeah, it was weird. We got the, this is again, this time frame that makes your brain explode. The show came out in December. We we got nominated. The actual award ceremony wasn't until August. So the record deal wasn't cut until it was the nomination that got us in, but the record deal wasn't really put together until March, maybe. And so, but it had to be delivered before Christmas. And so it's like, oh, okay, sure, why not? and let's start from scratch. But the good news is that a couple of the songs that had been cut down significantly for TV time, et cetera, like Joy, got to have its own real deal. This is the way the song was supposed to sound, kind of thing. Because the original has like a drum break in it. It has a longer guitar solo. It's got some other stuff going on. And it got cut. I mean, this thing, the way it worked out was, it started out as 30 minutes, then it got cut down when they sold it to CBS, and then it got cut down more because when the Raisins came in, they had to make room for the Raisins at the end. So everything had to shorten up, dialogue, everything shortened up, because you had to keep it down to 26 minutes, I think, for commercials or something like that. Right. Anyway, Joy was I was very happy to be able to put that back in its full form. Then from that point on, we knew that the Camels, you know, the Camel Bop was something that was popular, and it stood up okay. We put on, we went ahead and put the Carol of the Bells on there, even though it's a visual. But what I did was some voiceover stuff on there to make it make sense, because on the TV show, it's you have to be able to see some of the stuff that's going on. As it was, I ended up throwing in some extra voices that kind of gave a little bit more context. You could actually follow it as it went along, but it's weirdly out of place when if you're thinking of it as a pop record. I mean, it doesn't really peak there.
A good evening. Tonight, our concert is with the Paris Bell Harmonic, the house orchestra here at Notre Dame Cathedral. I have a hunch they'll give us a wonderful performance under the baton of Maestro Quasimodo.
Look, sir, it's Dumbbell.
See, and I think I would have rather had "O Christmas Tree" in place of that one, because the bells is like one of my favorites of the whole special. But the voiceover stuff, it's not, you had to do what you had to do to kind of make it flow, but it doesn't quite work as well. And I would have rather had like the slower song. You know, pop albums have slower songs on them sometimes. You know, there's a few ballads there, so.
There was politics to it as well, because the producer of that segment was Craig Bartlett, who was one of their senior producers and, of course, went on to great success. I mean, he still is doing, I think, Dinosaur Train or whatever that show that my grandson watches repeatedly. You know, Hey Arnold, he went on and on. He did Pee-wee's Playhouse, a bunch of other stuff, but great guy. I mean, really, really a talented, very creative guy. And so I kind of understood. And John Logue actually did the animation direction on that one. And so it's one of those things where it's like, oh, okay, you know, that's going to stay in. But the rest of it, to answer your question, I said I was prone to tangents.
okay.
Anyway.
It's not a podcast if you don't go on tangents.
There you go. The rest of it really was a matter of first saying, what are my favorite Christmas songs and how can we trash them? You know, I mean, what can we do to make them really different? What can we do to mess with them? You know, it's kind of a trademark. I mean, in the later years, I was in some bands. This one particular doppelganger was a bunch of studio guys. And our trademark was to take any cover we did and just completely turn it upside down to the point where it wasn't. I mean, we did like Peter Gabriel's Shock the Monkey as a reggae ska something with electric violin, you know, that kind of thing. So anyway, so this became, you know, we have 36 minutes to cover. We know we've got three songs that we know we're going to take off the record. And at that point, they weren't really dictating to us what they wanted. In fact, our so-called Atlantic rep was a very first time executive that had been hired. This was his first gig, young kid who turns out to be the most successful human being on the face of the earth. Toby Emmerich. He is a huge movie producer and music producer, et cetera, et cetera. Toby Emmerich, it was his first gig. We drove around Portland together. The kid, he was such a nice guy, but he didn't have any real opinion about what went in there. He just liked it and he was looking for new talent. And so that's partly why I put a lot of Northwest people on there, was a chance for them to have a little showcase. But it was proximity. I mean, I could get a hold of some of these people and they would show up. So anyway, the songs ended up being thumbnail versions that I kind of rough voiced myself and then got kind of a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And really, they didn't really were thumbs down. I think there was one other version of Silent Night that was too I don't remember, kind of lounge clubby, I think is the term they used. So then we brought in Linda Hornbuckle, and it just kept going and going and looping. But anyway,
And all I can think of is Bill Murray on Saturday Night Live.
Well, that's probably how it came across on my demo, because I was doing the vocals. So yeah, so that was fun. I mean, once we got the green light, then it was just insane of bringing people down. I had a new studio at that point. I'd build at a place where we had a big 4,000 square foot outbuilding, and we had a brand new studio that we were able to use, you know, at our discretion. And I had bought a ton of gear at that point with my so-called down payment that I got. And so I got a, you know, 48 channel mixing console, got the E16. I got a ton of synths and other locked up gear and all sorts of stuff. And so it was great. And then the word got out and companies started sending us gear. And so we you know, we can get into the gear, but it was this thing where they were trying to get us to try it out because they knew we were breaking ground with some of this other stuff we were doing. But anyway, so that's how the songs came about. And so it's kind of what works, you know, what is fun, what can we do that is unusual, you know, that's different. And you know, some of those I listen to it, you know, every year, kind of like a religious, you know, homage to say, okay, listen, I'll listen to it one more time and see if it stands up. Some of it feels dated. I mean, there's no doubt that there's a couple of tracks that we were, in essence, emulating Michael Jackson or whatever. You know, there's a feel to it. But there's a couple of them on there that really, you know, still hold up, that I still enjoy listening to and remember the production and remember how they came together. So anyway,
I like the whole album. I think the whole album's great. Honestly, the only thing that I think would have been better is if we had gotten Oh Christmas Tree on it, which is funny because growing up, that was never one of my favorites. And as I watched it now with my kids, it's like, wow, this is really good.
it's sweet. It's a sweet production. It's pretty straightforward. And my daughters killed it. You know, they really hit. My favorite, I mean, I hate to say it because it was really a throw on. They needed another 3.5 minutes. And so I did the Up on the Housetop thing with my sister. There's a long story to that. We can get to that another time or later on, but yeah, I'll circle back on that. Don't let me forget to talk about that.
I promise I won't.
Anyway.
Okay. So you know which ones are going on. You kind of get some idea of what else to add, but you also kind of changed a little bit some of the versions. So like Angels We Have Heard on High. So that's the one that was just an instrumental done while the Walruses were dancing.
Right.
So what was the impetus for doing a different version? Was it just because they wanted a pop album, or did you just hear it and say, I want to do something completely different?
I like the song. Growing up as a choir kid, you know, in boys choir and everything else, that song is always, to this day, you know, Anglican church music is still kind of at the roots of my soul as I was growing up. And so I don't go to church a whole lot, but when I go, it's almost always a Christmas time where I know I'm going to get to belt some of the favorites. And that song, you know, the chorus is always pretty straightforward. I was extremely fortunate on that tune and some others to have access to probably two of the best vocalists I've ever worked with in my entire career. Ron Tinsley, who does a lot of the lead vocal work on that record. And then Marilyn Keller, who used to sing with Don Letarski and a bunch of, she was mostly a jazz singer. Ron was involved pretty much from the beginning with Joy, was the demo. He came in for that. And I met him again at a funny seminar or something like that. And he had a career as a pretty popular lounge singer in Hawaii. At any rate, this whole thing came together. He had just smooth, silky, perfect, great voice and could do pretty much anything you threw at him first time through. But throughout this project, anytime I needed a choir or I needed something layered, he and Marilyn could just bang together harmonies that were tight and first take and boom, boom, boom. They were just phenomenal. I mean, it was just phenomenal. So that really made everything. The Angels, we demoed four different groups trying to get that to happen. And then we ended up using Lee Jones from a acapella group called The Tones to do the lead part. And we tried to use the rest of the Tones, but they had pitch issues that we could not get over. And so Lee really sang the verse, I think, like three times or something like that. And then we just kept cutting it in and flying it in as we beat everything around it. You know, that the polyrhythm and everything else went crazy than everything else we did. But yeah, it was great. I mean, that was fun. But that the obvious reason was it just didn't work with the Walrus version. You'd have no idea what was going on. Because, I mean, you've got like the slide trombone bit in there where the Walrus is flying back and forth across the ice and everything. It would be like, okay, you know, I don't know what's going on here. So
yeah. Anyway,
it's all good.
It's really, it's a cool version because, you know, it's got like that opening bass line, which almost sounds a little bit like Styx. There's like, bit. I think what changing time signatures there. I mean, it's it's super cool. And I'm glad that you got to play with it because it's fun to listen to and you don't really get a lot of that.
I think that song particularly, my favorite part is the bridge where we off time the vocals against the straight. And it's something that I've had a number of people, you know, write and say, hey, can you send us the arrangement? And it's like, no, you know, there's no way I can notate this thing to make it work. Cause it all had to do with Marilyn and Ron being able to hit that pocket. I would sing them the part and say, can you do it like this? And man, boom, 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 boom. They'd be in there. But I think the way that slides out of meter against a straight four and then resolves at the end and slides right back into the lead, I think is one of my favorite pieces of the record, to be honest with you. As a drummer, it's cool.
Yeah, oh, I can imagine that you had a lot of fun on that. But like you can hear, it's almost like a I don't know, like a triple feel underneath, you know, on top of that 4/4. And that juxtaposition is just super cool. And
you can't count it very easily. We just had to sing it because it really is that da 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 da. Dun, dun, dun. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all. So it's a lot of fun, you know. Anyway,
yeah.
Music geeks again. I hope you have music geeks as your audience. I don't know.
There's a few, yeah. And okay, all right. I've been told that you know, even talking more about that stuff is super interesting. So either way,
okay, all right.
So you're coming up with these arrangements. You're trying to just do something new and original. Yeah. But you can hear a lot of different influences, you know, like there's some, the gospel, like vocalizations, there's like a jazz comping in there, like Motown, you know, street corner type harmonies, you got the Afro-Cuban rhythms and polyrhythms. And so, like, how'd you just like, really, how'd you put it all together? How'd you synthesize like all these different styles and, you know, make it just kind of cohesive?
Well, we were lucky. Well, thanks for thinking it's cohesive, but thanks.
I really do.
Well,
I think, like I said, I'm a composer. I trained in music composition. So I know when something doesn't work and I think it really works. So
I'll call it organized chaos. But no, the thing is that look, you're looking inside my brain as far as influences and things that are
right,
that are fun. And so for me as a drummer, I can't remember the composer on this. There was a song that we did in high school when I was in this amazing concert band with a great percussion group in the Hook. It's this song called Incantation and Dance.
And yes.
Yeah, so
I know that.
And there's,
I do,
there's
yeah.
this amazing repetitive, repeated percussion like break that happens all the way through it. Yeah, with claves have to be whatever, and the timbales. And it made such an impression on me as far as what you can do against a standard beat, you know, to mm-hmm. what polyrhythm really was. And then of course, Peter Gabriel came around and other people came around that, that made me start listening to African, you know, music. But then you realize that, wait a minute, this is not different than Dixieland. This is the same. You know, it's just, mm-hmm. they're just doing something different with the signature. This is not different than church music or gospel. It's the same because it's the chant against the, you know.
Right.
So it's not that hard to go, you know, far afield. The only song that really, you know, again, the one that my sister and I did of Up on the Housetop, that was strictly an homage to, I don't know, Monty Python and everybody else I could think of. But it was really kind of a thing to my mom, who, like I said, was into musicals. And so mm-hmm. this thing, you know, feels pretty straight, but then you listen to the dialogue, you listen to what's going on, and it's hilarious. I mean, the funny thing about that song is that long after royalties stopped on everything else, I would get royalties from international royalties, like, you know, $8 a year or something like that, from like Amsterdam and some of these Norwegian countries that love that song and played it every year, apparently ad nauseum, which I can't imagine that they're probably making fun of the United States when they played it, but it's because it's so random.
Let's get into it. So your sister is like a kindergarten teacher, right?
Oh, yeah. She's playing a kindergarten teacher, which wasn't far from where she was. She was an elementary music teacher at the time.
Okay, yeah.
I'm going to sing you a song about Santa Claus. If you're really good, Santa may come here to visit. Here we go. Up on the housetop, reindeer paws. Out comes good old Santa Claus. Down through the chimney with lots of toys. All for the little ones' Christmas joys.
Ho, ho, ho!
Who would go?
Ho, ho, ho!
Who would go? Oh, up on the housetop, click, click, click. Down through the chimney with good Saint Nick. Santa, are you all right? That was really a nasty call. It's okay, children. Santa has plenty of padding. I think he'll be just fine.
Yeah, so the whole thing was that I wanted it to feel traditional. So the music back is very traditional. You could sing along and it feels just like, you know, and it builds and we add glockenspiels and isn't this sweet? And it isn't until you're listening to what's going on to Santa, who's being brutalized by this class, basically, you know, with whips and a leaking dolly. Whip, yeah. And, you know, little Tommy, who my sister just nailed it, you know. That's not nice to do to Santa, you know. Anyway, it was
and it did remind me of like an aria, you know. I mean, it's like a full stage, like some of her speech is almost recitative, just that whole style. So yeah, it did have an oddly traditional feel to it. Yeah
Well, it was meant to, and the thing was is that we had a heck of a time getting through it. I mean, it was just she and I. I'd laid down the tracks and then I, you know, put in the effects and whatever. And she and I just had a heck of a time getting through it because we were laughing so hard. And there's some outtakes that never made it, that couldn't have made it, with Santa being a little bit profane. But it may have actually had more legs in the future if we'd left it in. But it was pretty funny. It was pretty funny stuff. Tommy. Anyway, yeah, the record was one of those things that, again, we finished it just in the nick of time. We had tons of brain damage that, you know, came back to haunt us. If you read the website, it came back to haunt us on stuff that Venton took shortcuts on. But at any rate, it was a great grand time. We had a lot of fun, and I was very pleased to be able to work with some of the really the best Northwest artists at the time. Calvin Walker was super big at that time. Marilyn, of course, Street Corner Singers were big. Johnny and the Distractions, Johnny Kuntz, who sounds like Bruce Springsteen and could have been Bruce Springsteen. I mean, he was like a half a click away from getting signed before Bruce, on the same label, the same everything. But I can't remember what the story was, but yeah, I knew Johnny well, from booking him actually in some of the clubs that we managed. But anyway, yeah, it was fun. We had a really good time.
How did you choose which singer to sing which track? Was it just kind of who was available, or did you have a specific,
I knew what I wanted. Yeah, I knew what I wanted. When I'd create something, I knew I wanted, if I could get this guy to sing this, then whatever. And once we got the Emmy, you know, everybody was kind of on board. It was, you know, Will had kind of a mixed reputation amongst the artist community up in Portland. And so when we won the Emmy, I had to get around it and say, look, no, we're paying you up front. And here's the, you know, we'll get your releases. We'll do this exactly right. You'll get scale minimum and everything else. But the thing was, is because I had a relationship already musically with a bunch of these people, including, like I said, I grew up with Terry Robb. He and I were buddies.
Right.
And he's phenomenal. He's one of these guitar players that just is phenomenal. And so he knew everybody, and we had booked shows. We'd done some other stuff together, and it was pretty easy to make a call here and a call there, you know. Although I got to say that, you know, like when we brought down Linda Hornbuckle, she brought down her entire family because she was very nervous about driving out to this guy's house out in the middle of the country. We lived, this house was out west of Veneta, which is probably 15 miles off of the I-5. I mean, so it's 15 miles off of Eugene. It's out in the middle of nowhere. And so I'm sure that, you know, just finding the place was something. So she showed up with a full entourage for her part. And we had a great time. And she was, you know, just an absolute
She's fantastic. She did the Silent Night, right? Silent Night, Jazzy Night?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she's got a great voice.
Holy night, all is calm, all is bright, round yon virgin mother and child, holy infant so tender and mild.
And again, most of that was just, you know, one take. I'd say, well, just try this, and then boom, she could do it. These people are consummate professionals. I can't tell you how many, with a couple of exceptions, I can't tell you how many things were one and two takes. They were just absolutely phenomenal. You know, the Street Corner Singers was a little bit different challenge with the Raisin part, because that was something where we had to lift, you know, because this is what Will Venton wanted. We had to lift note for note, practically, Berry Gordy's version. And so it was harder. It was actually harder to recreate something specific, that specific, and to find voices that could do, you know, what they wanted to do. I think that the version, the way it came out, was fine. It was good, and it had, you know, it had some juice to it. But it's not my favorite song by a long shot. You know, it's the other ones hold up on their own, you know, without the Raisins or without the whatever. So anyway.
Yeah. And I actually, God Rest Ye, actually, I think is one of my favorites on the album.
Yeah.
God rest ye merry gentlemen, let nothing you dismay. Remember Christ our Savior was born on Christmas Day to save us all from Satan's paths when we were gone astray. Oh, times of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, times of comfort and joy.
Again, Ron could sing anything. And so, you know, he would bring something to the table on every take that made it just like, yeah, you could go ahead and do that. That's fine. That sounds great. And then I'd go back and lay against it. But again, that was a case of saying, how are we going to mess with something that people know really well,
right,
and turn it upside down, but still make it recognizable? You know, and right. So that was kind of the goal of everything, you know, that we did. It was keep it familiar, but at the same time have some fun with it, you know, let it well, grow. So,
and one technique I noticed that you do kind of go to is the where you have almost like a halftime verse and then like a double time refrain, and it does add a lot of energy to it, which I quite enjoyed.
Well, again, that's the drummer side of me where what you want to do all the time is play faster than you should. So, you know,
I understand. It's that
thing. Go ahead and lay that down. But yeah, no, it was, and really it was an opportunity to give dynamic, you know, to give some sense of dynamics to songs that could be very repetitive. You know, I mean, Christmas carols in general are very repetitive.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. It was fun. It was a good time.
So, I got to ask. So what would you say would be your happiest like memory or moment with either the special or the album?
You know, there were so many, I did not have a bad time. There was one time in Spectrum Studios when we were trying to lock up new equipment and old equipment. This is very techie and weird. So I had one of the first digital to audio converters. Sony sent us a 501 digital to audio converter. And so what it did was you used videotape as the capture source. And this is during a time when the only other digital decks out were like this $80,000 Mitsubishi 2-track that was a reel to reel. And Spectrum had one of those things, but you couldn't cut it. You couldn't edit it. You couldn't do anything with it. So this thing used videotape. In fact, I'm looking at it right now. I have this weird museum of old stuff in the corner. Anyway, you plugged in your VHS to the back and everything else, and it gave you pure digital clean. I mean, you know, 400, you know, cycles of great sound. The problem is that for the TV show, we had to lock this thing up. And so, you know, to the video. And so we had laid Simpty timecode down with this Fostex Simpty generator that they had also sent us. We had one of the very first of those. And so we had this thing, and Spectrum had advertised that they had a Simpty lock that would lock between the 60 cycles hertz stuff and the Simpty code, right? They had this machine. You do all of this audio and video and all these different things because this machine could do it, right? We sat, I kid you not, for almost 12 hours while the reel-to-reel would whir, click, and then start to act like it's locked up and then stop, and the other machine would stop. I mean, 12 hours, this thing went on and on and on. And we were like, God, we can't do this. We can audio lock it. We can do this visually. And this guy, this poor guy, the head guy there, was just so adamant that this was going to work. It finally worked. And we don't know why it didn't or did work. We have no idea. You know, as far as I'm concerned, someone threw a bathroom light on and it was just enough of an impedance change or something for the thing to work. But it was insane. That was the worst time I ever had. The best times for the TV show were really going to the studio and working with these amazingly talented creative animators who had these ideas that were off the charts, and you were watching it happen. Every room, there's this big facility that was like a big giant expanded warehouse. Every room was a different scene. And so every scene was being animated frame by frame by frame by frame. And wow, you would see this stuff in real life in different sizes and whatever. And they were such energetic, fun people that had all come through art schools and whatever. They were all hired on the fly for the most part. And then clear in the very back, I always felt so sorry for, clear in the very back, away from everything else, in this little black room, was Christina Sells Took, who did the clay painting for Joy.
For Joy.
And that was a frame-by-frame clay painting. And she was the sweetest, funniest person, but she was always back there in her little dark hole. She was so happy when anybody came to say hello.
poor girl.
Anyway, it was great fun. We ended up going to the Emmys together. She was on the group that went to the Emmys. But yeah. I don't know. There's that was going up there and doing the work was the joy of that project. Seeing it on TV and seeing the debut and stuff was cool, but we'd seen it in so many different forms, you know, that it was fun to have family and everything else, but that wasn't the apex. Yeah. It's the album was because it was such a time crunch, and we did it at our studio and then at Gung Ho Studios, Bill Barnett. He had a 24 track that we could lock up and do some other kinds of things. And we locked up his studio for, I want to say 4 weeks straight, where we re-edited and cut and brought people in and did other versions and did overdubs and stuff. But it was so fun. Every single day was just joyous. So there's no way I could say one thing was better than another. I mean, there would be some amazing solo or something that day and whatever. And then when we were done and delivered it, it was kind of like, now what do we do? I don't have anything else to do. I've been working on Christmas for 2.5 years. I have nothing else to do to go back to being an ad agency guy again. So anyway, that was great.
That's cool. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, when it comes to like arranging music, you know, putting it together, doing your own arrangements, like just selecting the piece, I think is like half the battle. What's the other half of the battle, you think?
You know, it's funny. It's changed over the years. The other half used to be kind of getting it out fast enough in your head. I mean, I don't know how you write, but for me, it really does just come almost otherworldly, all complete. It's like in a full form. I have to get it down. I have to capture it before it goes away. And so that used to be the challenge was, you know, luckily I had lots of gear. And because I had, again, I had an ad agency for 17 years, I was used to going at it and banging out it and, you know, being up all night sometimes to finish a project. So that part used to be the challenge. I think now, quite frankly, the challenge is you have so many options at your disposal that you have to be careful not to paint a brown picture. You know, that's the analogy that I can't remember who said that. Maybe it was Peter Gabriel, somebody like that, that basically said, you know, you have to know when to stop. Otherwise, you keep adding colors and colors and colors, and pretty sure pretty soon it's just brown. And so, you know, it's learning to go backwards. So now, you know, when I produce something, I still do production on the side for bits and pieces and projects. I'm mostly retired at this point and have been for a while, but this is, it's still a challenge. I mean, I've got a six or a 24 track portable deck that I take out for fun. And then I've got, just like everybody else, I've got myriad, you know, sequencers and computer this and computer that, and I use Reason, and there's no end to what you can do with that thing. And the hilarious part, of course, is that the entire setup that I have right now that I use commercially didn't cost as much as one of my vintage microphones. I mean, not one. And then my wife wants to kill me because she doesn't believe I'm going to finish it. But I was just working on it again this weekend. I have this semi-museum of all this stuff, these incarnations from the early 80s, or actually late 70s, but certainly early 80s, all the way through, all these different, you know, forms of technology. And from the 501 to the first Kurzweil sequence, you know, all these things.
Wow.
Firsts, you know, we had first in Sonics, first, you know, some of the first series of Fostex, first everything. So the board I have that I did all this work on, and then myriad other projects, the E16, the Kurzweil MIDI board controller, and I think a fax machine, are out in my garden right now. And I'm building this installation where the ivy is growing over the top of it. And it's literally an homage to progress, because that's how much it's worth. I mean, that gear, once it started to break, I couldn't afford to keep it up. And then all the digital stuff came out, and it's like, why would I ever go back to 16 track analog again? You know, I mean, I have stacks of 1-inch tape that you can sell on eBay for like $100 a reel, you know, but it's like, no, it's my baby. Somewhere in there is all of these projects we did, you know, but anyway, it's pretty weird. Pretty weird.
That's cool.
It's fun.
Super cool.
Yeah, I mean, the running joke for years was, how much was that computer? $2,000. Every year you'd get, I mean, you started with an 8088, and then a 286, and a 386, and a Pentium, and whatever. They were all $2,000. And they lasted about 2.5 years. And then you'd get, you know, the next incarnation of whatever.
Yeah.
Well, because your stuff doesn't run fast enough, and you can't do enough with it. But anyway, yeah, it's... in some ways, I feel like I wish I was born 10 years later so that I was younger and in this stuff. But at the same, you know, because there's more control now, obviously.
Right. Yeah.
For the artist world, you can put out whatever you want. You know, there's all these different streaming situations, all those different things you can do. But at the same time, I feel really, really, really lucky to have been right in the middle of the bleeding edge. I mean, we were some first streaming networks of in the computer company that I started. I mean, everything we've done has been pretty much right on the bleeding edge. There's no money in the bleeding edge. You bleed money in the bleeding edge. But it's really, really exciting, because you never know what's coming down the pipe. You know, you've got the first of everything. So, which is great fun. Anyway, that was a very long answer to a very short question.
That's okay. I'll take it.
Sorry about that.
No, that's quite all right. Patrick, it's been amazing talking with you and learning about the album and the special and everything, but you know, what do you got coming up? Like, what do you want to plug?
You know, this is gonna make you laugh or cry. I'm not sure. If you read the site, you know that this project went into a black hole that happened due to some copyright issues that Vinton had with Priority Records and the Raisins and all this stuff. And of course, the Raisins were a late ad. We didn't even need them, which is the most frustrating part. But it played for 5 years on CBS, another five on Disney. And then it disappeared. And then the video rights got sold to somebody who put out the DVD. But they used audio that I think came off a VHS tape or something. And it's awful. I mean, the audio is awful.
Right.
And so you go, okay, well, I'm not going to be sharing that with my kids. So now we're in the streaming world. We're in the streaming world. And I kid you not, every single Christmas for the last 25 years, at least, I get anywhere between 200 and 300 emails of, I love this record. Where can I find it? Well, you can't. And that's the problem. So the deal is that between Ahmed Erdogan dying, you know, some of these, the people that were involved going on to bigger and better things, you know, like, you know, Toby, I mean, he doesn't probably remember this project. Maybe he does. I don't know. It's his first. And then Vinton passed away and his company got mired with Phil Knight and all kind. I mean, it was a very ugly, weird transition in the early 2000s. Somewhere in there, the word didn't get passed along to put this thing up at least on Apple Music or something so people could listen to it and or get to it in some way. I don't care about the money. I swear to God, I do not care about dime one at this point. We made lots of good money, good royalties, everything else at the time. But mm-hmm. I would just like to have it out there so that when somebody emails me, I don't have to say, yeah, go to my website and it's there kind of legally because I'm a copyright holder, but it's really not legal because I don't have Atlantic's Grace yet. But luckily for me, I have a very good friend who's a copyright attorney, and this is the 35th year coming up. And at that point, things change with copyright ownership. And so one way or another, this thing's coming out this Christmas. So that's what I'm plugging, is that it's going to go up, you know, whether for 2 weeks before they make me take it down again. I don't know. I don't think Atlantic Key is even aware of what they could do with it. I mean, that's the thing. It won an Emmy. It was big at the time. I think that it would be fine. Just put it up and let it stream. I mean, everybody else streams everything at this point. Why not? You know, at some point this year, and I'll send you a notice when I do it. I'm putting it up.
Oh yes, please do.
I've got the masters. I've got a good quality sound. I'm putting it up. It will be there. So at that point, my kids and everybody else and grandkids can actually go and play it in their car, you know?
And that would be, I mean, that's like a fantastic Christmas gift right there. I will buy the heck out of that because it was one of my favorite specials. I loved watching it.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, it just kind of vanished.
Yeah.
And well, I remember being really bummed.
And there was no real reason for it. No one really knows the answer. That kind of died with Will. Will was a little cagey. And I think it had to do, and this is totally supposition, so I can't be sued for it.
Right.
But I think it had to do with when he started losing control of his company and Phil Knight came in and swooped in, and there was a lot of stuff where he ended up being very bitter at the end about losing a lot of his traction. He was a professor at the Portland Art Institute or something, you know, for a while. At any rate, I think what happened was almost out of spite because he didn't have very much to do with it. He just didn't care. I mean, it wasn't really his project. And so he just let it slide. I don't know where the original paperwork is. And so it's one of those things that I'm going to put it up on a hope and a prayer. I have all the album credits, of course, and it's all over the backs of the records. So it's pretty easy. And it's on IMDb and all that stuff. But bottom line is, I'm going to put it up. I'm 68 years old. What are they going to do to me? I'm going to be 69 soon. They can't do anything to me. By God, I'm putting up my music. So anyway, it's pretty
well. Let me know because I will pick it up for sure.
Well, it's I hope you don't have to pay for it. I hope you can just stream it on Apple Music, you know, or I've got a distro account and I'm just going to put it up there and they'll disseminate it out into the many worlds of streaming at that point. But if nothing else, it's just going to be off my back. I feel so bad and I reply to all these emails. And so I always feel bad, you know, that go on my website and you can hear the songs, you know, you can even download them if you're asleep. But and it's not a big deal. I own them. It's not like it's with the exception of the Raisins, you know, there's nothing else to dispute. You know, they're my arrangements. So anyway, I don't mean to sound like a crazy, bitter old man. That's not the case. It's I've had a wonderful, long, musical and crazy fun life. So And my daughter's getting married, thank God. So it's going to be great.
Congratulations again.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I've been blessed. They're great kids. So
right on. And well, on that note, I'll go ahead and end it by saying, Herb, haven't you had enough Christmas goodies? I told you there was a song about snacks. So check us out on our social media pages, Facebook and Instagram at Totally Rad Christmas, Twitter at Rad Christmas, or our Facebook group, Totally Rad Christmas Mall and Arcade, where you can make your voice known to us as well. We post anything and everything 80s or Christmas related. And if you're feeling like celebrating songs about Christmas trees and stacks of gifts, reindeer and jingling bells, holiday ballet, Santa Claus, universal joy, and Christmas snacks, leave us a review on iTunes. It helps us reach more people and spread some rad holiday cheer. Now, don't forget to check out our merch shop on tpublic.com and our super dope website, totallyradchristmas.com, courtesy of Tis the Podcast Elf, Tom Crow. Thanks for joining us for our Claymation Christmas Carol. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Later, dudes.
And mercy mild, God and sinners reconciled. Joyful all ye nations rise, join the triumph of the skies. With angelic hosts proclaim, Christ is born in Bethlehem. Hark the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King. Sing glory to the newborn King.